accession number 23439, Reel 3.
John Adams in Reel 3. You were telling me about the building.
Oh yes, when we got to Madang, one of our majors with a party had gone ahead, and the mess huts were supposed to be ready for us and all that sort of thing, and they weren't. And of course, the old major had told them how he wanted them built. Of course, that wasn't the way the natives had built huts. And that caused the first hold-up. Well, finally they agreed to build them as the major wanted them. But before they could do that, they had to carve some little wooden gods and put on all the corners around the building. And they had to be duly blessed, I suppose, by the whoever blessed those things, before they could get on and do the work. Later on, they built huts for us and built them to their own specifications, which, of course, were much better. Kept the water out, stood up to the winds and everything else. But these things that the natives do have been learnt over the centuries. But that was the first hold up there, and one that you couldn't have foreseen, really, I suppose.
Did you like them?
What?
The native people?
The native people? Oh, yes. Likeable people. Decidedly likeable people.
Including the Solomon Islanders?
Well, I had so little to do with them. They kept away from us. And any of those people who had to deal with them said the same thing. You won't get very far with them. They didn't want us there. I don't think they wanted anybody else there. That's been the trouble ever since with the mining.
Can I go back to the Burness Peninsula?
Burness Peninsula? Mm.
The Japanese were trapped in this peninsula, rather.
Yes, Burness Peninsula and Burness Island at the end of it. And we were supposed to clean them out of that, which no doubt we would have done in the end if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb. But they'd got pushed forward up until they were there at the end.
How many of them were there?
I have no idea. I never did hear.
What condition were they in, do you know?
Starving. Absolutely starving. There was one deserter brought in on one occasion. I didn't see this, but he was brought in a landing craft, a small landing craft. He couldn't stand up when they got him into the little port. And the provost sergeant just put his hands around his neck and pitched him up like that. Absolutely starving. And there was a certain amount of cannibalism went on. It's often been denied since, but I've heard transcriptions from their own diaries regretting that His Imperial Majesty's troops could descend to those levels. A sergeant I had at one time, he was killed at the end of the war, and actually helped bury some of these natives, some of these Japanese who had been butchered. That was in New Guinea, up at Itapi. He was working along with our padre. And they were chucking them down, giving them what sort of burial they could give the poor things. But they had been chopped around as for butchery. Regrettable, but these things can happen. But they were starving. Absolutely starving. All except on New Britain. They were all well fed. Because General Imamura, they said he established himself as the biggest market gardener in history. Every piece of ground that could be tilled on that island, or that northern part of that island, he had them growing sweet potato, tapioca, dry land rice, anything in the way of food. And those troops there were in excellent condition. They were a bit soft because they had no meat. They needed that. where they'd be put four men onto lifting something that two of our men would have lifted. But the Imamura had them in very good condition, and he had no supplies in at that time, I believe, for something like 3 years.
Well,
you had to take your hat off to Imamura. He was a very, very efficient, capable man. He'd never been against white troops. He was finally indicted as a war criminal because it was his troops that were responsible for the so-called rape of Nanking. And he was finally jailed up in the Philippines somewhere as a war criminal and continued to grow vegetables and feed the local community.
Did they have any allied POWs on New Britain?
No. No, they... war graves people were always looking for traces of a certain artillery regiment that simply disappeared, never had any trace of it at all. And they were always coming around wanting, if any bones were found or anything, they want to see them, see what they were, see if they could find any trace of them. And it's been assumed that they were probably all put onto a troop ship for shipment back to Malaysia. And it was sunk. There was never anything discovered about, I forgot the number of the regiment now, but they never discovered a single trace of them at all.
Was this English or Australian?
Australian. I think it was, yes, it must have been an artillery regiment. Just one of those sad things, it probably was. It was simply shelled, torpedoed or something. They wouldn't know, wouldn't a Japanese ship, you see.
Would the native population do anything to help Japanese in difficulties?
Never heard of them doing so. Never heard them doing anything at all. And never heard of them being impressed as labour troops. We did, we impressed them as labour troops. I never heard of the Japanese doing it.
So what, were you very long on New Britain Island?
Not all that long, I suppose. I got over there, I suppose, in possibly November. Might have been early November. And I was gone again by February. I was discharged from there.
Is that the story you told me at the beginning, where you went back to the farm?
Yes.
February 1946?
Yes, my father wrote to me, and it was... He wrote to me, I was in New Britain by that time. And like everyone else, I wanted to get out of the army. Well, the war was finished.
How do you feel now about having served in the AIF in the Second World War?
Having
served in the AIF in the Second World War.
Oh, I'm not sorry I did. I'm anti-war, but I mean, these things happen. You get involved in it.
Have you had any after effects of having served?
No. No. Well, I'm deaf, that was probably due to that too. 2-pounder blast probably, but I don't know if you could prove it. Well, without this thing, I wouldn't be hearing you.
You're hearing it.
Mm. But as far as after effects, no, not at all. You might say I had a good war.
You were telling me something about how skillful with their hands you found the Japanese.
Yes. They have very small fingers. And until you see them beside your own fingers, you don't realise how small they are. It was born upon me forcibly when I saw them repairing their own wireless sets to go back into their own tanks. And where our men would get a pair of tweezers or forceps to get into these wireless sets, to hold the wires in place, to solder up, they put their fingers in. And it's things like that that make you realise how small their hands are and how incredibly useful they are with them. When you see what they can do, you can understand how they produce those wonderful artifacts, carvings, paintings, all that sort of thing, because they are so good with their hands.
Were their swords confiscated from them?
Yes, they were ordered to hand in their swords. The officers had swords. They were ordered to hand in their swords and their binoculars. And they were to be distributed on a sort of pro rata basis to the troops. Well, when our consignment came along, the old man, the colonel, said, "All right, all my officers are going to have a pair of binoculars and a sword. There they are, go and take what you want." So we hopped in and we selected what binoculars we wanted, what swords we fancied, so I had my sword and my pair of binoculars. I selected a sword, which was a little different from the others. It was a little bit longer. And in some ways it was appreciably different. And I won't go into the details of this, but I eventually discovered from the original owner of the sword that it was dated back to the early 15th century. It was, what's the period? Japanese periods. Anyway, from the very best period of sword making. All the details, of course, are engraved on the tang of the sword, the part that goes into the hilt. The name of the sword maker and the dynasty under which it was made, and I think the name of the emperor. I knew all this was on my sword, and from that they were able to tell me exactly, almost exactly, the age of the sword. Very interesting. I can't think of the word.
Of the period?
The period.
This is not the Tokugawa period, is it?
Say it again?
Tokugawa?
No, that's not right. It's quite a well-known word. Anyway, it was from the very earliest period. And the sword had belonged to his grandfather. It was given to the man from whom I got it, who was a captain, just about my own age, actually, written down on paper. It appeared he was a year older than me, but of course, like the Chinese, babies are considered a year old at birth. So in fact, Captain Nee and I were the same age.